So much of what we do is either online or connected to something online. Marketing for businesses and organizations often includes posts on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We often share plans for vacation, pictures of family, and discussions of times for meetings, and much more on social media. Appliances, from our televisions to our refrigerators, are also connected. We're still trying to figure out what all of this means. Next spring, Stephanie Schulte, Associate Professor of Communication in the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences, will lead an Honors College signature seminar series about the Internet. She teaches courses in new media, communication technology, media studies, media literacy, and cultural studies, and is the author of Decoding the Internet in Global Popular Culture. Tomorrow evening, she'll deliver a free talk previewing her spring seminar series, and the address is free and open to the public in Gearhart Hall on the U of A campus beginning tomorrow evening at 5:15. Stephanie says teaching courses about the Internet means courses are ever evolving.
I can say that I have been teaching for decades now, and I have never taught the same class twice.
Is that exciting or frustrating?
It's both. I mean, it's a little bit like trying to study a treadmill that you're running on. You know, I feel like a lot of what I do in my class is designed for flexibility because something happens. Some big event happens. Like I remember when the Facebook revolution happened in Egypt, we just basically dropped everything for that week and we started just reading in to what that meant, right? So a lot of times we, you know, move items around in the schedule and try and make room for what's happening. And that is one of the goals of the class, right? If I teach things that are happening now, I give the students information, but I'm giving them information that is going to be obsolete. What I want to do is encourage critical thinking practices that they can take with them, that they can add new information to and ask questions that are going to help them throughout their careers and throughout their lives in terms of, you know, how to go about learning new things about technology.
You remember a time before the digital revolution, before the Internet, certainly before smartphones. Most of your students don't.
Yes. So I am a digital immigrant. Mm-hmm. We are digital immigrants and they are digital natives. So they come to technology with a different set of assumptions and a different mindset. And that is part of what makes teaching them great because I learn about new positions, new ideas, new practices. They keep me questioning and they keep me informed.
This is asking for a broad generalization, which isn't fair. But do you see young people, say 18 to 25, approach giving up information or data to digital sites differently than those of us who, say, have an age that starts with a 4 or higher?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I hear them say a lot, privacy's dead, it's irrelevant, it's obsolete. I'm also, you know, I'm not doing anything wrong, so why would you care, right? So a lot of times the questions that they ask – the questions that I ask them seem antiquated, right? So, you know, I oftentimes try and push past those questions and just sort of think about scenarios in which they might care. So say you are buying a pack of cigarettes and your life insurance goes up, or say your networked refrigerator reports that you've got a lot of, you know, processed foods in it, and all of a sudden your health insurance goes up, right? Or all that sort of differentiated cost. Say that you get a really good job and your data profile says that you're affluent and you can afford higher prices, and all of a sudden Amazon doubles whatever it's sending you, right? So there are things that happen sort of micro level that people might care about.
Is that theory or fact that my connected refrigerator might have a connection to my life insurance or health insurance premiums?
Well,
I mean, does that actually happen? Will that actually happen?
I'm not sure if we know, right? Yeah. A lot of that is priority, proprietary data. So a lot of what happens in these companies that do data collection is scholars sometimes call it the black box. You know that data are being collected, but you're not exactly sure which data set or what companies are going to be doing with that data set. And that is a place that we are really different from other countries, in particular Europe. So Europe has comprehensive data rights policies that do things like require that you are informed about what data are collected and who's collecting it and what is going to happen with those data sets. And then those data sets can only be used for those particular things, right? So in Europe, you have a lot more transparency than you have in the United States, right? And part of that, I think, is because we in America trust companies a lot more, right? We always think about companies as shielding us from government incompetence, right? Companies mm-hmm. work better for us, we think, than the government. And in Europe, they really think about government as protecting them from companies. And so that sort of difference is made, you know, a different sort of data policy. So part of the problem is that we don't really know. And companies aren't required to tell us.
Interesting experience I had over the summer. Three separate times, I had a conversation with someone about a very specific thing. Like really specific. Within 12 hours, I had a Facebook ad using those specific things. Am I paranoid? Or can that happen?
Yes. So in the terms and conditions of apps and of different programs that you're using, in terms of platforms that you're using, you might be giving away some data. Your companies might be able to turn on the microphone. They might be able to turn on the camera. They might be able. So, you know, there are ways in which you are being monitored through those terms and conditions. So one of the activities that I'm going to do in this class is have students read the terms and conditions and actually read them, which most people don't do.
And they have eyesight still good enough to read right. them, right?
Right. And yeah, in fact, actually, some scholars have argued that all cap type font is actually designed to be difficult to read so that you're less inclined to read them. But yeah, there one company, I think it was a British company, famously wrote into the terms and conditions that you gave up your immortal soul to the company. And so...
So you'll have them read some terms and conditions.
Yeah, and I'll probably ask them to pick ones that are for platforms that they use, right? So I want them to know the terms and conditions for the platforms that they're actually using. A lot of times, once you read them, you actually will take it off your phone. So Bitmoji, for example, I took off my phone after I read their terms and conditions. And so, you know, I'm not invested in them taking it off or not taking it off. What I'm invested in is the students being informed.
What were the terms and conditions that you didn't like with that?
Well, a lot of apps will actually be able to record whatever data you put into your telephone at all and a lot of locational data.
We give a lot of ourselves up when we do things online.
Yes, we do. And we do that in part because it makes our lives better. We get better products. We get better services, right? That's what some scholars have called the tyranny of convenience. So that's, you know, we would, you know, even after reading the terms and conditions of Facebook, I'm still on Facebook because it connects me with my friends and my colleagues. It's a professional place for me. It's a personal place, and it's worth it to me. And especially given the fact that I have only opt-in or opt-out. Those are my only two options in terms of the terms and conditions, right? So I can either give Facebook all of my data, or I can not use the platform. But I don't have an option of adjusting the terms and conditions in the same way. So even if I cancel my account, all I'm doing is hiding it from myself. Facebook still continues to collect data and keep data, the data sets that I have.
Even if you have jumped off.
Yeah. And even if you're not on Facebook, some studies have shown that Facebook still collects data on your IP address. In fact, they collect data and hold it longer if you're not on Facebook, because that's the subgroup that they want to study, right? They want to put you on. They want to try and figure out how to get you to join.
It sounds like in 2017, for someone who's professional or trying to market something or trying to learn information, it's going to be very hard not to give up some data.
Right. And that is the I would love for my students, actually, in some of the other courses that I teach, to have media fasts, right? To have to take completely disconnect from all sorts of online screens, like take all screens out of their lives. But I can't ask them to do that because they'll fail. They need it for their lives. They need it for their jobs. They need it for their families. And I can't actually ask them to do that. And that compounds even more in the workplace. To some extent, some companies will actually require that you hand over your social networks as part of their contract. So you actually, and that be, those social networks become part of the property of the companies that you work for.
Is there any way you can find out what data has been collected on you? Do you, you mentioned that Europeans have many more rights than perhaps Americans, but is there, you know, allegedly, if you write the FBI, they have to give you the file, if any, that's on you.
You are, the companies are not obligated to give you data sets. So, in Europe, a guy named Max Schrems wanted to test the European data directive laws. And so he solicited all the information that Facebook had on him, and it was like 1,200 pages worth of data. And a lot of it was wrong. A lot of it was illegally collected, he alleged, and he was spearheaded a mass consumer lawsuit against Facebook. But in the United States, there isn't that mandate. So Axiom will give it to you. Mm-hmm. And you can go and look up your own data set from Axiom.
We've talked mostly about social networks and Facebook and things like that. But there is the Internet of Everything,
yes,
where there are some new houses where you mentioned refrigerators early, toasters, TVs, microwaves, all of this. And so that's all potential data to be mined.
Yeah, and what you've what those things give companies is access into new spaces of data collection, places, locational data, activity, mood data, and increasingly you'll have embodied technologies that will also be data collection. And anything that's connected to the internet is hackable. So you can hack a pacemaker with a cell phone. And we've got LCD contact lenses, or you know, anything that's tech that's wired is hackable.
So my big problem is understanding the tightrope to walk. When am I too paranoid about data? Because when I hear people say pacemakers and 747 cockpits and contact lenses, that does make me want to run and live in a cave in Devil's Den.
It makes you get your foil hat out.
Right, right. So what percentage of me should be tinfoil hatted?
Honestly, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm not a data scientist, right? I'm a historian.
Right.
So I think about these things in a way that's more long-term thinking instead of scientific thinking. But my friends and colleagues that are data scientists tend to be less connected. They tend to be on Twitter because Twitter has a history of not sharing as much data as other social networks. They tend to not have. I mean, you think Steve Jobs was super restrictive on what technologies his kids could use. Right? He did not allow his kids unfettered use to technology. Right? Was that because of data or because of cognitive effects? You know, I don't know, but probably both.
Is there anything we lose by just looking at screens more often than we used to? Or is there any difference in if you're reading on a Kindle or if you're watching everything on a screen as opposed to getting out and walking outside, besides the exercise and all that?
Right. Yes, of course. You read better on paper. People read better on paper, especially if you're reading something that has hyperlinks. So hyperlinks are those blue words, or oftentimes blue, they're not always blue, but something that's clickable that might lead you to another page, for example. Once you see a hyperlink, your brain switches into decision mode.
Oh, so do I want to keep reading the text, or do I now want to go to a new page?
Exactly. So what you get is a switching cost. So your brain switches from comprehending a text to deciding about whether you want to click or not. And it goes back and forth. And in making that switch, you actually have cognitive loss. And so you actually don't comprehend things as well. So there are lots and lots of studies that show that if you read on a book, on a stagnant piece of paper, even a stagnant text on a screen is better than something that has hyperlinks.
What about listening all the time online, streaming music instead of buying it or having it on something you own or can put in your hand?
Yes. So the myth of multitasking,
right? Right?
Multitasking doesn't really exist that often the way that we think about it existing. What you really do is task switching, or you monotask in rapid succession, right? So you go between your tablet to the person you're talking to your other screen, to your paper, right? And each time you make one of those switches, you have cognitive loss. And what the consequences of that are actually quite profound. You lose creativity, out-of-the-box thinking. You're unable to assemble the information and retain it. You're unable to access the information to the same level. So you may get more inputs of information. So you might have access to more information, but you're also going to retain it less, and you're going to understand the complexity of it less.
So if for your professional life or to some degree your social life, you need these connections, but use of these connections might affect attention or cognitive ability, I'm beginning to think about how we use these technologies like a diet. Like, you don't want to eat only red meat, and make sure you have the fruits and vegetables. So it kind of sounds like you want to monitor in that sort of way?
Yeah, I think you want to systemically monotask at brief moments in your life, right? You want to give your mind the chance to be quiet and to be idle. You want it to be able to work, because when you're idle and when your brain is quiet, that's when you do all of the structural work inside your brain that creates memory, that moves things from your working memory into your long-term memory. You also should look at a tree. Studies have shown that if you look at a tree for 20 minutes a day, you create that quiet mind, and it actually will help you retain your memories better. It'll help your cognition. It's that mindfulness trend.
Stephanie Schulte is an associate professor of communication at the University of Arkansas and the author of Decoding the Internet in Global Popular Culture. In the spring, she'll lead an Honors College signature seminar series about the Internet at the University of Arkansas. Tomorrow evening, she'll offer a free, open-to-the-public preview of that seminar. Her talk begins at 5:15 tomorrow evening in Gerhard Hall Auditorium on the university campus.